First case is People v. Hunter, case number 2010-SC-146. Case is set for 45 minutes per side, and the appellant, in this case the Attorney General, will have to keep track of your time. And please state your name before you start. Are both parties ready? And the one thing I want to mention to those of you here and also in the audience is that some of us, but not all of us, will be using iPads, and we have all the briefs and our notes on the iPads. We're not looking stuff up on the internet. Well, we might be looking up cases that you cite, but not surfing. So with that, we'll go. We're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kathy Gillespie, and I'm here on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado today. My registration number is 26109. As the court's aware, it's taken five cases currently up on review. We're going to hear today and one case tomorrow. What I'd like to do is start by giving you the framework that the people believe should be used in all of these cases, and that consistent framework, if applied throughout all five cases, will end up with hitting the legislature's intent, which is to identify and monitor, once placed back into the community, some of the most dangerous sex offenders that we have in the state of Colorado. So if the court will indulge me, I'll start with the framework and then move on to the specifics of the Hunter case. The framework is important because we need to have, one, guidance to the trial courts. As the court's aware, having looked at these cases, the trial courts and the Court of Appeals need guidance in handling this issue. Right now we have courts all over the place, whether they're using the Webster's Dictionary, the Sex Offender Management Board, various parts of the statutes, and we're coming up with very inconsistent results, which doesn't benefit anybody. It doesn't benefit the defendants, and it doesn't benefit the community. So first of all, the people that we're trying to identify are the sexually violent predators. And these statutes came into place after the Jacob Wetterling Act, the federal law, was passed in the early 90s, telling the states that they needed to put into place registration and an overall system to identify some of these sex offenders, to keep track of them once they're placed back into the community. The feds told the states that they needed to identify a person as a sexually violent predator, and that determination needed to be made by the court after considering the recommendation of a board of experts in the behavior and treatment of sex offenders. After that, our General Assembly put into place the Title 16, 11.7101. And what that did was it told specifically what their intent was. And what that was a standardized and comprehensive system to identify, treat, manage, and monitor sex offenders. It talked about that it was necessary to have that standard and that program based on evidence-based standards, and that at each stage of the process, that would be reviewed and updated based on the current research as we got more and more of these people on the sufficient community notification and registration requirements. The Sex Offender Management Board would be able to go back and study and see how accurate each time their identifying factors were. So based on that, the legislature then went on to 16 11.7103 and created the Sex Offender Management Board. And as it stated in 109, as a body, the Sex Offender Management Board is one of Colorado's most important resources on the treatment and management of adult sex offenders. It is vital to inform the decision of the policymakers. And then it asks the SOMB to report to them annually and to give input on legislative changes that were necessary. In the duties of the Sex Offender Management Board, there are two or three specific sections that apply to the sexually violent predator. The first is subsection 4A, which talks about the standards for the identification and evaluation of sex offenders and that the standard should include management and monitoring based on the research. Also, in subsection B, it talked about the continuing monitor of sex offenders while in treatment and while under the supervision of the criminal justice system. Then we moved down to 4D, and 4D talked about the risk assessment screening instrument. And in that section, the legislature said that in cooperation with the Department of Justice, the SOMB was to consult and advise on a risk assessment screening instrument to assist the trial court in making a determination about the likelihood of reoffense. If you take those various subsections and you apply them to the sexually violent predator statute, which is 183414.5, the legislature, following the outline from the federal legislation, said that a sexually violent predator, unless the context otherwise requires, is an offender. And then we get to our four-part test: over 18, date of the conviction, and then the two that are at issue in the majority of these cases. Number three, whose victim was a stranger or established or promoted a relationship for the primary purpose of sexual victimization. And number four, who, based on the results of the risk assessment screening instrument, is likely to reoffend.
Does the federal formulation or statute include that kind of inverse wording have any to do with the victim and the offender?
In the stranger section? I think right. In the federal, it says that the victim is a stranger or the defendant or the offender established or promoted. I don't think the language
Well, precisely, a victim is a stranger to the offender.
Correct.
Right? Now, is that the same in the federal formulation or not?
In the federal, it says, it doesn't say that. It says just a stranger. The victim is a stranger. It doesn't specify whether that's the victim's a stranger to the offender or the offender is a stranger to the victim.
The victim is a stranger, not the offender is a stranger. I mean, I keep tumbling over those words in the briefs and in the statute, and I hope you'll help explain that.
I am. I'm going to help you.
Great. Thank you.
So, to make sure that we're on the same page, the SVP statute and subsection 4, the risk assessment, I'm going to refer to as the SORS, S-O-R-S, because that's what the Sex Offender Management Board refers it to. And I know it gets confusing because the Court of Appeals, the trial court, refer to a variety of initials, but so we're both, all of us are on the same page. Subsection 4 is the risk assessment. That language, every time it is used in these statutes, whether it's the lifetime supervision, the sexually violent predator, the discretionary sexually violent predator, every time that subsection 4 is used, it uses that exact language, whether or not the offender is likely to reoffend under the relationship circumstances described in 3. Now, where the defense and the prosecution have disagreed is when you move on to subsection 2 of the sexually violent predator statute, it says, when the defendant's convicted of one of the enumerated crimes, the probation officer and the evaluator who are doing the mental health sex offense specific evaluation must complete the sexually violent predator risk assessment. And this I'm referring to as the SVP-ASI. And that based on the results of that assessment, not the SORS, but that assessment, the trial court needs to make factual findings about whether or not the defendant is a sexually violent predator.
So, Counsel, can I stop you right there? Because
sure.
I'm very interested in this difference in language, because the 1A4 talks about the risk assessment screening instrument, and as you note, subsection 2 talks about risk assessment, and you're saying that the risk assessment in subsection 2 is the SVPASI, the overall assessment. And I'm curious about that because the language in subsection 2 refers to the sexually violent predator risk assessment, not a risk assessment. And so, in my mind, the reference to the risk assessment suggests that it's referring back to the 1A4 particular instrument, the SORS. I'm just curious as to how, or the source for the creation of this overall risk assessment that purports to apply to the first three factors of the SVP finding and not just the fourth.
And there are a couple of things in the text of that number two that help explain that. One is that it talks about the assessment as the probation department. It says the probation department in coordination with the evaluator completing the evaluation. Probation department does not fill out the SORS. That is done by a licensed psychologist. So if the probation officer is filling out part of it, we're talking about the overall document. So the defendant comes up for sentencing, he gets his PSI, he gets his sex offender evaluation, which is the big one with the criminal history and all that. Then he gets the evaluation, which you all have been looking at, which is the four parts total. And that includes all four factors of the SVP. And we know that because what it says is, based on the results of the assessment, the court shall make specific findings of fact and enter an order concerning not whether or not the defendant is likely to reoffend under the circumstances in three, but it says concerning whether the defendant is a sexually violent predator.
Right, and so my take on that, considering the provision as a whole, is that of course the court is to make the final determination as to whether the offender is a sexually violent predator based on the four prongs, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And that language in subsection 2 is consistent with that. But the only actual reference to risk assessment pertains directly to the future risk portion under 1A4. And so I'm still struggling with why SOMB has the authority to put together an assessment that the trial court is somehow bound for purposes of 1, 2, and 3.
Well, and that's where we go back to that Title 16, 11.7, where it talks about that the standardized system that needs to be in place for the accurate monitoring, the comprehensive system, the standardized system. If you're not looking at the guidelines, the SOMB was specifically given the authority by the General Assembly to create this standardized system to help them evaluate, identify, monitor, and manage these sex offenders.
Right, but that's management and monitoring under the 16.11.7.103 provision that you cite. Doesn't talk about giving the SOMB authority to further define relationship, age, list of offenses, things like that.
Except for to accurately manage them in the community, they need to accurately identify which ones are the sexually violent predators.
And isn't that still separate from the court's determination of whether the offender is in fact a sexually violent predator?
No, because all four of those have to be present in order for the defendant to be included in a sexually violent predator. And if we're using, what we don't want to do is cast the net too wide. If we're using the Webster's Dictionary or the plain language of these terms, we're not accurately identifying the predatory behavior of the current crime in conjunction with the risk assessment in order to identify which ones we need to keep track of. So the SOMB guidelines are actually more narrow and more to the point of what we need to look at per offender in order to accurately identify them as the ones that are at risk for committing these predatory crimes. And it doesn't, when you look at the overall scheme of how the General Assembly has set this up, there is, out of 1611, 101, 103, and 109, all refer to the SOMB coming up with the guidelines and keeping the legislature apprised. And then my impression, and from looking at all of these statutes, is that subsection 2 is referring to the overall sexually violent predator risk ASI, and that's right. How the SOMB breaks it down. When in their handbook they explain that the overall SVP ASI is the sexually violent predator determination, and this is their input. Obviously, the trial court gets the final say, but this is their input on here are the factors that you should be looking at to make that.
Right, and I guess sort of construing subsection 2 with subsection 1, it would seem to me that if in fact the risk assessment were designed to, or the General Assembly wanted the risk assessment to be considered for purposes of all four prongs, it would have shown up in Part A. As used in this section, sexually violent predator means that if based upon the risks, based upon the results of a risk assessment, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And instead, the reference to the risk assessment shows up only with respect to future risk.
But it doesn't show up only with respect to future risk. It shows up in subsection 4, where it talks about the actual SOAR's part of the evaluation. But then in number 2, it talks about the overall document, the probation department in coordination with the evaluators completing these documents. The evaluation, the assessment have been completed. Based on the results of the assessment, the court shall make the findings on the SVP. Everywhere else, when they are only referencing the SOARs, the actual, I want to say psychiatric, but psychological testing, it talks about whether or not a defendant is at risk to reoffend, whether or not somebody is a sexually violent predator, and whether or not somebody is at risk to reoffend. The risk to reoffend is one part of the sexually violent predator statute. And when you, yes, the language as you proposed it would have been obviously more helpful, but when this was written, this hadn't been created yet. The SOMB had been given the guidelines in order to do, okay, to put this together with the DCJ.
And I'm sorry to belabor the point. I'll just, you're basically relying on the language in subsection 2, the reference to complete the sexually violent predator risk assessment, and based on the results of that assessment, that is the statutory language that you rely on to say that the trial court should look at the risk assessment for purposes of all four factors.
Correct. In conjunction with the 1611.7101, which talks about the monitoring. The sexually violent predator statute is part of the monitoring and management of these sex offenders in the community. So the general authority of how we're going to monitor these people, what we're going to look for, is given in the Title 16. And then in Title 18, when it gets to the exact sexually violent predator factors, it again references back to this general assessment. And again, as I said earlier, the language that they continue to use is constantly stepping on each other. It's never delineated as clearly as we would like it to be. But when you look at the handbook of the Sex Offender Management Board also says, and I understand it's not binding precedent for you all, but it does show that in order to make that determination accurately, the board has created the SVP ASI, of which the SOARs is one part of, and the SOARs relates directly to subsection 4.
Okay, and I'm sorry to have taken up so much of your time. Perhaps you can move on to the stranger portion.
So keeping that overall framework in mind, I think it's important for the court to understand people's position is that the trial court does have discretion to agree or disagree with the Sex Offender Management Board. What we are proposing is that the Sex Offender Management Board needs to have that tightly contained discretion, as this court pointed out in Hernandez, and keep it within the confines of the factors that the experts have told us relate directly to determining whether or not a person should be designated as a sexually violent predator. So we don't want to cast the net too wide. We don't want to cast it too narrow. Webster's Dictionary, trial attorneys, trial court judges don't have the expertise to tell the legislature and to tell the community which ones need to be appropriately monitored. So the General Assembly saw that and gave that power to the Sex Offender Management Board with the reporting requirements coming back to it. So if we take that general framework and we look at Hunter, there are two prongs of that framework that are highlighted. One is the definition of stranger and what we're going to look at when we determine that. And the second is it highlights the remedy issue that we have here. As the court's aware, Court of Appeals are making alternative findings. They're refusing to address other prongs of the relationship status, and they're just wiping out the SVP designation and turning these people back to the system with no monitoring in place if and when they ever get out of prison. And Hunter directly addresses that. So the stranger relationship criteria, and again, the people believe it's important to come out of these cases with a framework. That may mean that I lose some of these cases as an SVP determination. And I'm okay with that, because if we're using the framework of the Sex Offender Management Board, if factors don't indicate that this particular person needs to be monitored, then I don't believe they should be monitored.
Ms. Gustin, can I ask you a very elementary question? I'm just a little confused as to your fundamental argument about the relationship between Section 2 and the sex SOMB. Sorry. Could you just repeat that? I mean, I understand what you're saying about based on the results of the assessment. That makes a lot of sense. I understand what you just said about the tight discretion and that we should rely on experts based on empirical evidence. But I'm a little unclear about you use a term that I was just not familiar with, based on 16. Could you just run past Title 16?
So 1611.7101 mm-hmm. has the General Assembly's general intent on these sex offenders when we put this standardized system into place.
Right.
Standardized comprehensive system for the ID, evaluating, managing, and monitoring sex offenders.
Right.
That's directly in line with the federal law, which is what told us we had to put this in place. 103 of Title 16, 1611.7103, then lists the Sex Offender Management Board duties. Mm-hmm. So it's creating the board, which includes people from all aspects of the criminal justice system. And in that particular, especially 4A, 4B, and 4D, it gives the Sex Offender Management Board needs to come up with this system that's going to manage and monitor. Subsection B is the continued monitoring for as long as they're under the supervision of the criminal justice system. Subsection D, again, talks about the SOARs, and we know that D relates to subsection 4 of Title 18 because it's the exact same language. Then in subsection 4D, and this might go back to your point, Justice Martinez, talks about, separates out the SOARs, and then it says that would be created by the DCJ and would assist the trial court in making the risk determination of whether a defendant is likely to reoffend within the confines of the relationship categories.
Right, and I guess that's the part that I find troubling, because that's the exact language that appears in 1A4 of, well, in fact, there's a direct cross-reference there, right?
It is, and so my point is that subsection 4 is telling that Title 16 is giving the Sex Offender Management Board in cahoots with the DCJ to come up with this SOARs. And that SOARs is going to answer a very specific question, and that is the risk to reoffend. So they take that, they put it into Title 18. Mm-hmm. But that risk to reoffend is one factor of the four factors of the SVP.
Right.
When you read Section 2 in Title 18, it says that it's based on the results of the assessment, the trial court, based on those results, the trial court's going to make the SVP finding. That assessment is the overall assessment that is talked about in A and B, the system that's coming up to accurately identify these. So subsection D is talking about one factor that makes somebody a sexually violent predator, but there are other factors that they have to look at. The legislature gives the SOMB the three relationship factors from the federal laws, but the SOMB has to tell us, what about establishing a relationship for the purposes of sexual victimization? Clearly makes you a sex offender, but does it make you a sexually violent predator? Those are two different things. And in order to distinguish between those two, the Sex Offender Management Board came up with factors based on their research and their case histories, came up with what makes somebody who establishes a relationship with somebody for the purposes of sexual victimization, what takes them from a sex offender to a sexually violent predator? And if you look at the factors, and we'll see this as we go through the cases today, if you look at the factors, they highlight certain things that common sense would also tell you would make somebody more of a predator than just a sex offender. And those are actively manipulating the environment, using force, criteria such as that to us as lay people, we would understand, well, that obviously makes this sex offender more violent or more predatory than this one over here. So yes, the language is confusing. In a broader scale, if you look at Title 1611.7, the General Assembly gave the SOMB absolutely every aspect of dealing with sex offenders. It makes no sense that this one aspect on the most violent of our offenders, they're going to leave up to the Webster's Dictionary.
Let me ask you a question. I think that where the rubber hits the road here is the whole concept of evidence-based sentencing, which you seem to be suggesting has been deferred to the board to gather evidence and come up with some sort of a construct based upon lots of experience and lots of evidence as to who will fit into certain kinds of categories. Is that a fair way to kind of summarize that?
It is, and we see that in the difference between the 2003 and 2010
sure.
evaluation.
And that's an ongoing thing, and it's basically consistent with the modern trend toward evidence-based sentencing. The problem is, I suppose, in all of these cases is where this philosophy of evidence-based sentencing meets what goes on in the courtroom and the discretion of the judge to take into account the victims and just everything that happens in a courtroom. The judge's even personal philosophy or what he observed during the trial, perhaps the way the defendant was acting during the trial, all sorts of things that are a little bit intangible and hard to express, but nonetheless go into making a sentencing decision.
It does, but I think that's a very good distinction to point out, is that nothing about what we're talking about with the sexually violent predator designation changes the trial court's ability to take all that into consideration for the sentence.
And I know I'm taking your time, and I just want to tell you that this is what's in my mind as I'm listening to the arguments this morning, is how we're able to figure out for ourselves what, maintaining, I think, what's a very, very, what's really, truly valuable about evidence-based sentencing with allowing the judge that kind of discretion, which we can't get rid of. And I've now taken your time. Thank you.
Okay. I have more time. I'll be back.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie.
All right.
Respondent.
Hello, I'm Joan Mountier, and I represent Mr. Hunter. So far, this hearing has sounded more like a legislative hearing than a Supreme Court argument. And it's all very interesting what happened before the statute was adopted, but my client was convicted, was found sexually violent predator under specific wording in the statute that has been, that the legislature formulated after hearing all about what we just discussed. The statute is clear and unambiguous. The court did rely on evidence at trial, finding my client a sexually violent predator. But when you have a statute whose language is so clear and unambiguous, you don't need to resort to other rules of statutory construction. Because the statute says a person is a sexually violent predator when, among other things, I'm sorry, I'm very nervous, the victim is a stranger to the offender. The statute doesn't say the offender was a stranger to the victim. And in People versus Tixer, Court of Appeals case, the court said it's not difficult to understand how the statutory definition applies when a victim is a stranger to the offender. The court said a sexually violent predator is one who sexually assaults a stranger. It's very clear.
I'm not so sure of that. In the facts of your case here, our case today, he was wearing a mask, so he's certainly concealing his identity. It certainly seems as if the intent of that language, although it's hard to parse the passive, the active voice in it, basically means if the victim is assaulted by someone who's a stranger in the circumstance of, admittedly, under the facts here, is a violent offense.
It's a violent, there are many violent offenses, but
this is a masked man intruding into this trailer and violently, the actions demonstrated, the factual actions, violating the victim, right? So why doesn't that fit perfectly into the idea that it's the offender's conduct in this circumstance, masking himself so he can't be identified and setting up this situation where he attacks the victim?
because, Judge, the statute has very, very clear language. It's written from the offender's standpoint. And
yeah,
why is
the offender puts on the mask, sets up the scene, and commits the assault.
The offender knew the victim. The victim was not a stranger to the offender.
Well, wait. Under these facts, and the ID was at issue, I mean, the defense raises the idea whether ID question, was this even the right person? Do we have the right person here?
Well, ID was not an issue in closing argument for the prosecutor. He argued that they were
talking about the facts as we're presented with them in the case.
Right.
As it relates to the statute and the intent of the statute. So,
And the victim was not a stranger to the offender if they were neighbors and lived next door to each other.
How would you tell that when a masked man comes in and makes the assault? You know, if this is a neighborly kind of situation, he appears as a neighbor.
Well, Judge, you're looking at it from the victim's standpoint, and the statute is not written from that way. And
no, I'm looking at it from the offender's standpoint, who masks himself so that the victim cannot tell that this is someone she knows.
He masked himself. An offender would do that if the victim was not if the victim was not a stranger.
Oh, come on. That makes common sense.
Counsel, let me come at it perhaps a little bit differently. In my mind, the word stranger connotes a broader relationship that exists and not necessarily, you know, under the circumstances of the actual offense, whether the victim can actually identify the defendant. It would seem to me that the problem here is, unless you look at the broader relationship, otherwise you're in a situation where any time the victim is unable to identify the defendant, you would be in the stranger box. It could occur in the dark. The offender could blindfold the victim. Is that kind of where you're headed in terms of construing the word stranger as opposed to the victim's ability to identify the defendant under the circumstances?
If the state wants to have a statute that says the victim is a stranger to the offender, but if a person wears a mask or somehow otherwise conceals himself or herself from the victim, then he's a sexually violent predator. You need to put that in the statute, because in this case, the victim was not a stranger to the offender.
And that's,
I mean,
because
I don't know what's so difficult to understand why we are.
But I guess you're saying that is true because we're talking about the existence of the relationship outside the specific facts of the offense itself. We're looking at the broader relationship that existed between the offender and the victim in this case, and there was evidence that they knew each other. They had been over to the offender's house for dinner, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, thank you.
And it's written from.
Let me stay with that 1 second, because I still am a little concerned about the term stranger. And you've said a few times that this is clear and unambiguous, as if stranger must have one meaning. It's not defined by statute, right? It's not treated as a term of art that we have a specific narrow definition of. So we're faced with the question, do we give it an ordinary meaning? What is an ordinary meaning? I guess I might just ask you then, if it's clear and unambiguous to you, how would you define what a stranger is?
A stranger is a person that the offender does not know, because we have the offender in that statute, so you can't separate stranger from
offender. And for a moment, let's not worry about from whose point of view it is. I appreciate the point you're making there, I think, in the phraseology. But I'm just curious about stranger. Does that, when you say that the offender doesn't know, do you mean he's never seen before, or he's never been introduced to, or he doesn't have some kind of relationship that might be relevant to a sexual relationship? How do you take stranger?
I think it would depend on the facts of the case. And these are very particular facts.
Well, that's my point. And the essence of the crime and the way that person is treated through all this criteria is predatory conduct, correct? Predatory conduct, as opposed to sexual offense without predatory conduct. And certainly masking yourself to commit a violent assault is a predatory in nature, is it not?
Well, you would mask yourself if you knew the victim.
Ms. Montier, what about, what's your reason for rejecting the SRMB definition of a screening instrument, stranger?
It's a perfectly fine definition, but the legislature did not adopt that definition. And it could, if the state went to the legislature and wanted to have that wording added to the statute.
Well, as I may be wrong, but I was under the impression that they hadn't developed it at the time the legislation was put into place.
Well, maybe they should go to it now.
And it seems to me, I mean, what's the rationale? I understand your argument. If it's not specifically in the statute, then don't apply it. But you want us to apply the dictionary, whereas the rest of 16 at setting up the board indicates that the legislature wants a certain amount of deference to the SRMB. So why is that just as good as, if not better, than the dictionary?
Because you apply the plain and ordinary meaning of a statute, of the language of the statute, is clear and unambiguous, right?
Well, I agree with that. It's hard to argue.
So you don't, I mean, that's my answer.
Okay.
Could I follow up on that just a minute? So with regard to the question, actually your opponent's argument about whether the legislature intended for this definition to take on the specifics or a flavor or maybe to be defined at all, stranger, by what the SRMB says. Are you suggesting that the legislature couldn't do that, that that would be some kind of an impermissible delegation or something, or just that they haven't done that?
They haven't done it. They could adopt, you know, they can adopt whatever, you know, they seem fit to adopt. And then they have to answer to the public.
So basically, you contest the statutory interpretation that Ms. Gillespie presented to us.
Absolutely. The statute doesn't say the offender was a stranger to the victim. It says the victim was a stranger to the offender.
I think what Justice Coates might be asking, and please interject if I'm incorrect, but I think where he was headed is whether you agree or disagree with the people's position that the legislature delegated to the SOMB to further define these terms.
Yes, but it didn't delegate to the Supreme Court to insert that language into the statute.
So you do agree with the people that the SOMB has the authority under the statute to further define stranger or establish a promoted relationship, those aspects of the third prong of the SUP statute?
They did. But that's for the risk assessment. It's not, you know, that risk assessment guides the court in its factual finding of whether a person was a stranger to the offender or established or promoted a relationship.
So if they know each other, there can't be predatory conduct. Is that what your argument is?
If the offender knows the victim, and you have to have a, I believe,
okay, so
as Justice Rice was saying, you
regardless of what the facts are, the predatory conduct part of this that may animate our interpretation here is removed. You can have predatory conduct so long as you know each other.
So long as the victim was a stranger to the offender. That's what the legislature came up with. That's what the legislature
That's your interpretation says. Of what the legislature came up with.
It's,
we have to look at the circumstances of everything interconnected.
You do, but there is a statute with language that is very specific. I mean, that's all interesting what she talked about, but now the legislature heard all that. And they came up with this. And it's a statute that says a person is a sexually violent predator if, among other things, the victim was a stranger to the offender.
So they intended under your vision of it to have a total person who comes out of the blue and in this circumstance. Most rapes are committed by people that have some acquaintance with each other, right? That is the general circumstance, right?
And that's what,
so you're positing that it has to be somebody who has never met this person before.
I'm not.
Never seen this person before, who out of the blue commits this assault. And that's the only thing that's defined as a predator under this system.
The legislature has made a judgment that they want to target a certain class of offenders that they deem, based on all this information, is the most likely to reoffend and therefore a sexually violent predator. And they came up with a statute after hearing, you know, in one of the legislative hearings, Ms. Jones, forget who she was, said that we are targeting a certain class of individuals, a certain class of sexual people who commit sexual assaults.
Do you recall from your review of the legislative history, that portion that you're referring to, whether there was any discussion of this kind of hybrid situation where there was a disguise involved, rendering the person a stranger to his victim, although he knew the victim?
I do not recall that. But if that's
rather
problem,
your impression from your review of the legislative history is it's the classic stranger rape where, you know,
yes, she said,
Washington Park rapist or something like that.
I remember she said most rapes occur within the family or among people who know each other.
This is this type of sexual assault, in my experience back from when I was a trial judge, it doesn't happen very often. It's usually one or the other sorts of categories, truly a stranger rape or, you know, a rape or a sexual assault where there's some family or friendship kind of relationship. This is really an unusual situation, and you don't recall anything at all which would help us dig a little bit deeper into what might have been meant?
Well, I don't think you need to you don't need to because the statute is clear and
I understand that's your position, and I gather you're telling us that you don't think they really discussed this at all as well in the legislature.
I don't think they discussed disguises or masks, but however,
okay,
I might
thank
be
you.
Mistaken.
Can I ask one more question about stranger, and the way it's phrased in this sub 3, it talks about whose victim was a stranger to the offender, but then also or a person with whom the offender established or promoted a relationship, blah, blah. Do you think it's important to look at both of those alternatives to determine what the legislature had in mind by stranger, or do you think these are two totally unrelated provisions?
Well, if you're a stranger, then you can't have the other part of the statute if you have a relationship, if you're not a stranger, so you can't.
Can you render yourself a stranger by taking on a mask? I mean, one person knows another, but if you put on a full body mask or just a head mask, you no longer know each other. You become a stranger.
Well, not to the offender.
I suppose I see that position. Yes.
Correct.
I guess where I was going with that a little bit is the second half is clearly related to sexual victimization. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be wanting to pinpoint somebody who has a relationship that facilitates sexual victimization. And so if you're somebody who established or promoted that relationship, then you get to be a sexually violent predator. The other is a stranger, but again, I'm not quite as convinced as you, I guess, where it's not as clear to me that that can only mean one thing. And in trying to determine what that means, whether you've met the person, whether whether you remember them at the time, whether you had a particular kind of relationship, should we look at stranger also as attempting to deal with a relationship that facilitates sexual victimization. And therefore, if one doesn't have that kind of relationship, either if he establishes or promotes it, that makes him a sexually violent predator, or if he doesn't have that kind of relationship, does that make him a sexually violent predator?
Well, I think the subsection Roman numeral 3 has to do with what is the relationship between the offender and the victim. If strangers, you go to the victim was a stranger to the offender part of the statute. If there's some kind of relationship, then you have to ask about the second prong of that, which is, did the offender establish or promote a relationship? But you can't be a stranger and establish or promote a relationship. I think that's the distinction in the statute.
But then the stranger seems clearly to be if you're somebody that doesn't have some kind of a relationship with the victim.
Correct.
But what kind of relationship is that that would make you a... What kind of relationship are you not to have that would make you a stranger? It could be that you've never seen this person before. I take it you're not even going quite that far, are you? It could be that you've never met them. It could be that you don't have a relationship with them that would facilitate sexual victimization. I'm kind of looking for where along that continuum, how we should think, how the legislature intended to define stranger. And maybe they intended to allow somebody else to do it, but you've pretty much, obviously, you're in the position that they didn't indicate that. In which case, what did the legislature mean by that term? And frequently we talk about looking at the whole context of the statute, trying to determine through whatever aids what the legislature had in mind, what kind of a person, what was their objective in designating these two classes of people. And that's the kind of thing I'm curious if there's...
Well, their purpose was if the offender sexually assaults a stranger, that is a particularly dangerous person to reoffend. If an offender establishes or promotes a relationship with a victim, that's another type of person who is particularly dangerous to offend.
Well, in either case, it has to do with the offender's conduct. When you line it up with this risk assessment and the experts who have something to say about this in the process, right? So we have to look at what the offender has done with regard to making this relationship a stranger.
You have to look at the relationship of the offender.
No, you're looking at relationship as just a kind of a status. I'm talking about the conduct that has been perpetrated here.
Correct.
By the offender.
But the statute is talking about what's the relationship between the offender and the victim. That's that part, Roman numeral 3 of the statute, is talking about the relationship, not the offender's conduct.
Now we're talking about sexual violent predation. And I cannot see how, when you look at this case, when a person puts a mask on and then commits a very violent rape, that a casual acquaintance in a trailer park or even a visitation that, you know, may have involved dinner is the same thing as dressing up in a mask so that the victim can't identify who you are under the violent circumstances that the legislature could have, in any event, not considered that in connection with this assessment process, not violent conduct by a predator.
Well, it's looking at the relationship to see if you're going to likely to reoffend. He's already been
convicted. Correct. Now, a person who puts on a mask is likely to reoffend. Isn't that right? I mean, you've got some other persona now that you put on to perpetrate this crime. That to me is one of the indicators of a person who is going to do it again. Right?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. But are we looking at the offender's conduct or the victim's conduct?
You're looking at the relationship between the offender and the victim for this statute. You know, in the sexual assault, if you're convicted of that, then you're looking at that conduct.
Okay.
To convict a person.
I've asked it as many times as I can, and I'm going to be satisfied with the fact that we're not going to move on with this and examining what the overall intent of this statute is, so.
If the offender knew the victim, would the offender be more likely to wear a mask?
Likely not. In that case, the offender is going to insinuate himself in this case. I recognize this is a gender-neutral situation that can happen, regardless of sex involved. But in this, the other thing has to do with, you know, the victimization, the or piece of this.
Right.
Knowing somebody and then setting up the circumstance.
Right, but the court didn't make any findings on that part of the statute.
Actually, while we're on that point, could you give us your position on the need or the lack of a need for remand to have further determinations on the established or promoted relationship prong? The Court of Appeals suggested that the record might support such a finding, and I believe the people have asked in the alternative that this court remand to the trial court for purposes of such additional findings. What is your position with respect to the remand?
The Court of Appeals in 2004 remanded it for specific findings on the relationship part of that statute.
And the trial court didn't make those findings, and so...
It had the opportunity, it was argued, the district attorney argued it, the court only made findings on the stranger part.
But having done so, it didn't necessarily need to go on to the other prong.
No, because it found it was a it was a stranger.
Right, and so my point is, why would it not be appropriate to send it back to go ahead and make findings with respect to establish a promoted relationship?
Well, because it already had an opportunity to do so. It's already been argued to the district court, and it found that the offender was a stranger to the victim. No, it didn't really find that. It found the victim was a stranger to the offender, and so it should be covered under that statute, and that's why it was incorrect.
Thank you.
Thank you. I ask you to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Ms. Rozier. I think we can turn to the next case.